Hello, all. Welcome back to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I truly appreciate your time, your energy, and your effort in tuning in every week, downloading the episodes, and spreading the news that we have going on over here at Captain Hunter's Podcast. Please make sure that you rate, subscribe, and share. I've talked about this before. It's very important for us to get this information out there. I want to be a reference and a resource for the community. And the only way that for that to happen is for you to rate, subscribe, and to share. I have to do my part creating good content, good episodes. Also, remember that you can support the podcast through Patreon. Go to my Patreon page, Captain Hunter's Podcast. Look for that. Become a subscriber, $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever you can do just to support the podcast. It's very important in order for me to keep this podcast going that you all just reach out and just give a little helping hand to me. Show me some love. That way I can keep the podcast going and so I can keep providing you with great information and good quality content. If you like the background music, once again, that is provided by my godson, Avery Herring. Go over to his email, AveryHerring, the number 2, at outlook.com. AveryHerring2@outlook.com. You can also hit him up on Instagram, Reggie Blight. That's REGGIEBLITE. So hit him up over there, Reggie Blight. If you like the new background art that we have, that was provided by my stepson, Philip McCorkle. So you can go to PM Design, DESIGN 808 at gmail.com. So if you like the work that he's done for my new logo, Captain Hunter Podcast logo, hit him up, PM Design 808 at gmail.com. Both of these young brothers are trying to do their thing, trying to become entrepreneurs. We want to support them in their endeavors. Very important that we support everyone in their endeavors. So as we've been doing, we're looking at the top stories for the end of the month. So that's what we're going to continue with for today, for the month of October 2019. We're going to look at the top stories for the end of the month segment that we have going on in order to get us to understand, you know, how we can make the communities stronger, the police department stronger, and so both of these entities can come together and not seem to be at each other's throats, but what we can do to make sure that they are working each other's best interests at all times. The first story that I want to talk about comes from Baltimore. A prosecutor down there in Baltimore, Marilyn Mosby, is going to vacate the convictions, take a look at the convictions of over 790 cases from tainted officers. There, anyone who's not been keeping track, you realize that there was a scandal that happened down in Baltimore. There was a gun task force down there, and they were involved in stealing guns, stealing drugs, selling drugs, racketeering, lying, falsifying evidence, falsifying reports, all kind of just criminal type of behavior. Many officers down there have been receiving jail sentences. Some have resigned, some have been fired, some have been reassigned. So it's just a complete mess down there. And as a result of this ongoing investigation that's been over a year now, at least minimum over a year, as a result of the investigation into the police department and how far the scandal goes, there is a, right now they're looking at about 25 officers from this particular task force and or reaching out and branching out. One article from the Baltimore Sun had it reaching out as far as to Philadelphia. One officer in Philadelphia may have possibly been involved in this whole situation. So this type of scandal is obviously terrible for law enforcement as far as their reputation. And that's why I had a problem with a couple of movies that are coming out. One is out now, Black and Blue, as I'm recording this, Black and Blue. There's another movie coming out, Queen and Slim. Just talks about more police corruption. Police are covering up crime. So the, you know, this is it. Once again, I'm going to ask the question, is this art imitating life or is this life imitating art, right? So are these producers and directors making these movies to tell about the narrative, to display the narrative about what's going on, unfortunately, with some police departments? Or is it that, you know, they're just mimicking what they see, or are they trying to set a narrative, right? So I'll leave that up to you to decide. But regardless of the situation, right, it's a terrible situation in which people are losing faith in the police departments because of scandals like this, right? Let's leave the fiction out of it. Because of scandals like this, they see one police officer covering up situations, planting evidence, dealing drugs than selling drugs, planting guns, and you name it, involved in all types of racketeering type of behavior. Racketeering being that, right, you're involved in conspiracy and it's a government enterprise, right? It's not just one officer doing it, but they've got court records. They have text messages, cell phone records of conspiracies to hide information, to steal information, and all kind of crazy nonsense. So as a result of this type of investigation that is still ongoing today as we record this, 25 officers have been either currently on the force or now are no longer on the force because of retirements or firings. Their testimony has been rendered void. Their testimony has been essentially labeled as garbage, and the convictions in trial cases and all that will be overturned. People will be more than likely released from jail and all this kind of stuff. And so someone would ask, why do police officers engage in this type of behavior? We're there to put and supposed to protect and serve. So what is it that would make a police officer engage in this kind of conduct? Why would a good officer who's gone through background checks, who's gone through a whole life, at least 21 or 25 years of, and I'm talking about from birth to the age till they become police officers, if they've been good, upstanding citizens in their conduct, in their reputation, right? They've gone through background checks, psychological tests. They've gone through all this kind of type of thing. What would make them turn bad? Well, I give a couple of theories about that. Number one theory is that there is a push to perform. What I'm going to call a push to perform. The push to perform means that if you want to get in or stay in this group, this specialized group, because that's what this gun force task force in Baltimore was. It was a specialized group of plainclothes officers who were chosen to be a part of a specialized task force that was assigned to getting guns off the street. And so therefore this push to perform comes in that you have to turn in so many guns, find so many drugs, create so many arrests if you want to, number one, get into this group, and number two, stay in these types of groups. And so this is what happens when a lot of times when specialized groups are formed within police departments or any other department, right? Or any other, I would assume any other type of legacy, right? If you want to become, let's just throw out the term doctor, right? If you want to become a specialized doctor, then there's certain hoops that you have to jump through in order to get to those committees, to those, and to prove your worth in that specialized group, right? So it's no different in law enforcement. You want to get into that specialized group, you have to have a certain resume and do a certain performance, have a certain educational level, all this type of things. Well, in law enforcement, a lot of times this specialized group means that you, in order access into the specialized group, means that you have to have a certain level of assertiveness. I would even say aggression. You would have to have a certain level, and they look at your arrest records. How good are you at sniffing out drugs, finding drugs? How good are you at getting guns off the street? And when they take a look at that type of stuff, they say, hey, this person over here, he's got a lot of arrests. He's able to find a lot of guns. He's able to find a lot of drugs. Let's place him in this unit. Entrance into these units may also come because of someone you know. Maybe you have a certain connection. In my own former department, we call it horses. You know, if you have a horse in this race, just a special term for a connection, right? So you know someone who knows someone, essentially. All institutions know that. There's a saying that says it's not what you know, but it's who you know, right? It's not a lot of times your education, but it's who you know. So, and this is the reason why we had that college scandal, right? So this is how the college scandal, as far as people getting these actresses and actors paying for their children to become members of Harvard and other elite schools. And how did they get to these places, right? It's not what they knew, but it's who they knew. So they knew the backdoor channels in order to get them into these certain elite Ivy League schools and things like that. So that's just a little bit of a side note. I'm saying all this to say that this type of thinking is not isolated in law enforcement. You think about wherever you work, there's some kind of specialized group that everybody wants to get in. And in order to stay in that group, you have to perform, right? You have to live up to the function. If every other member of the group is turning in 10 guns a month, let's just use that as a round figure. If they're turning in 10 guns a month, right, getting 10 guns off the street, illegal guns off the street, and you're only turning in 8, well, then there's this pressure for you to say, there's pressure put upon you to say, hey, listen, everybody else is performing at this level, you got to step your game up. Well, then that pressure becomes, well, I can't find it legally, so I'm going to find it illegally. I can't find the amount of drugs that other people are finding, or even if I am finding the same amount, maybe I want to now one up them. So this is the major reason why this type of thing where police cover-ups, false arrests, planting of drugs and evidence takes place. As far as people selling drugs, well, you know, they don't think that they make enough. And so they just want a piece of the pie. They see how much drug dealers are making from their wares, and they just want a piece of the pie. So this type of corruption, fortunately, is being stamped out. And fortunately, I hope that it is that this lesson that the district attorney down in Baltimore, Marilyn Mosby, is taking will help to rectify the situation as far as future officers engaging in similar type of conduct. Kudos to her. And I hope that everything works out down there. In this month of October, we also had the tragic death of Tatiana Jefferson. Tatiana Jefferson is, of course, the young woman who was playing video games with her nephew, her 8-year-old nephew, down in Fort Worth, Texas at 2 a.m. Good neighbor saw that the door was open around 10 o'clock p.m., called the police on the routine line. The police then responded a few hours later. Skulked around the house, went into the backyard, never announced their presence. When Miss Jefferson apparently went to the window to check on who was in her yard, the officer then panics and then shoots Miss Jefferson. So the officer in that particular case has resigned. Charges have been filed, and we'll see where that goes from there. Her family obviously was dealing with her tragic loss. And apparently some type of GoFundMe page was taken out, but her father, who was not with the mother in a relationship at this time, Miss Jefferson's father had taken out a policy, or apparently had taken out a policy, so he had enough money to bury her. And there was some questions as to where the money from the GoFundMe was actually going to go. The father of Miss Jefferson said that he did not need any type of assistance, that he had enough, that he was financially aware and astute enough to have taken out policies. So he had done the right thing by his children. So my point in saying the part about the family is that, listen, we got to make sure that we are on our P's and Q's and that we are taking care of business, and make sure that you're taking care of business as far as whatever you have going on with your life, right? Make sure that you have insurance policies. Make sure that you have the financial means and wares to support any action or any person that you bring into this world and that you're responsible for. So essentially, take care of your responsibilities. If you're not sure about your responsibilities, you're not sure about where you stand, shore it up. Get what you need to get and get where you need to get to, right? Take care of business. Handle your business. This man, Tatiana Jefferson's father, took care of business, and he said, listen, I don't need anyone else to come in here and help us. We have helped ourselves. And so I think that alone says a lot about this man's character. So I would say, and I suggest and hope, that all people out there would have the same feelings of wanting to do right for and by themselves. The LA Times released a report, another surprising report, stating that there were more black people being searched during motor vehicle traffic stops. In fact, the article reads, this is from the LA Times, LAPD searches blacks and Latinos more, but they're less likely to have contraband than whites. Here's a little bit from the article. The Times analysis found that across the city, 24% of black drivers and passengers were searched. And passengers, right? So if you're sitting in the passenger vehicle, you're going to get searched. Compared with 16% of Latinos and 5% of whites during a recent 10-month period. That means a black person in a vehicle was more than 4 times as likely to be searched by police officers as a white person, and a Latino was 3 times as likely. Yet whites were found with drugs, weapons, or other contraband in 20% of the searches, compared with 17% for blacks and 16% for Latinos. The totals include both searches of vehicles and pat-down searches of the occupants. So again, this would call into question why they're searching so many more black people. So there's a lot that goes into this type of data. I reached out to some people at Central Connecticut State University because they also are taking statistical information like the LAPD, and they're looking at how many times police officers are not only stopping different races. CCSU also did a report about this. I have reached out to them, and I'm going to reach out to them again because I'd like for them to explain, you know, what goes into this type of methodology. How is it that they're getting these numbers and this information, and what are the decisions of officers? What is behind the decision of officers to make these types of searches? Now, let me just give a little bit of background on this. There was a report released back in July of 2019 that I have, that I've been thumbing through. It's about 600 or 700 pages or so, something like that. And this is almost the second, this is the second report. Now, I was a police officer and a command staff, and I was allowed to go to when CCSU first presented their information to the municipal chiefs and the higher authorities and higher administration officials within departments. I was there actually when the first time that they presented their information. And so there was a lot of questions and a lot of pushback, because the decisions to search vehicles are often based on a number of different factors. And I want the scholars to present that information. And if not, then maybe I'll do another episode about that. But I want them to present their information as to how and why these certain situations, or what's behind the actual decisions of officers to decide to search cars. So one of the decisions that boosted the city of Waterbury's numbers as far as searching of vehicles, because let me just back up for a second here. So when Central Connecticut State University did their analysis, what they did was they looked at different cities and towns, and they looked at how many searches compared to motor vehicle stops that these towns and cities had. And so Waterbury's, our own department, was on the higher end. Well, one of the reasons for the higher end, this is why this type of statistical information is very important. You have to look into the reasons why. One of the reasons that Waterbury's incidences of searches of vehicles was so much higher is because our policy said that in order to tow a motor vehicle, we had to do an inventory search, and that counts as a search. So here's what happens. We pull a driver over. He has no license, no insurance, or no registration. It's something we always call the trifecta, right? So he had the trifecta, no license, no registration, and no insurance. So we cannot allow that driver to leave the scene. Even if someone else had a valid driver's license who was in the car, they can't drive the car because, again, it's not registered, and again, because it's not insured. So we have to tow the car. Can't leave the car where it is. More than likely, it's parked in, you know, we pull it over on a traffic stop. So we have to do something about the car. So we're going to tow the car. So now we had to do an inventory search. That was part of our policy, right? Because we don't want people to come back and say, well, I had a diamond ring in the glove box, or I had, you know, $1,000 mixer, studio mixer in the back seat. So these are the reasons that we did the searches, just to do a protection of our own selves as to what was actually in the car. Of course, we give the owners and occupants the opportunity to take any valuable items that they might want. So that was one of the reasons. That was our policy. And that was one of the reasons why our searches were so high. So it looked as though Waterbury was searching more individuals. Well, it was, and we were, but the fact of the matter is that it came down to we're searching, when I say individuals, what I'm saying is more vehicle searches. And so we were, again, because, and the reason that we were searching so much more than other people, other departments, is because of our policy. So you have to look at what was going on with this type of thing. The Phoenix police officer who was responsible for doing the bulk of the swearing concerning the little girl who took a doll from the 99-cent store has been fired. So just to remind you all of that case, there was a little girl in Phoenix. The family goes into a dollar store. Little girl, about 3 or 4 years old, sees a little doll, takes the doll, brings it to the car, and the family drives off. Supposedly, the family, the mother and the father, were unaware that this child had a doll. A passerby, not even the store, calls. So it's a passerby, it's a witness who says they see this little child take the doll. The police are called, and the police respond in the show of force that has been a viral video that has gone on. And we see officers showing there almost as if they're looking to apprehend homicide suspects, right? They're swearing, get the F on the ground, get the F in the car, you're going to get shot. all this kind of crazy stuff. So the main culprit in that particular case, that officer has been fired. Now, I think another officer needs to be disciplined as well. And that's the one who's kicking out the guy, the father's legs, telling him, when you do something, I tell you to do it. Watch the video. If you can sit through it again, it's absolutely horrific. Once again, to understand this, I'm going to say it again, and someone tell me that I'm wrong about this. I don't see them responding like that to any other family, any other particularly white family, right? So you're not going to go to Beverly Hills. You're not going to go to the country club and do this kind of behavior, right? So I think that there's this certain animosity. There's a certain stigma, whatever's going on in the minds of people, that there's a certain treatment that black people in their minds, I would assume, deserve. All this for a child who took a 99-cent doll or a doll from a dollar store, even if the dollar was $5. You're responding in this way in a show of force, guns drawn. If you draw your guns, that means that you have determined to use lethal force. Think about that. You have determined to use lethal force. That is the force that you're going to use. And you're going to kill someone over a doll. You have to make better decisions about the things that we are doing. Chicago releases investigation showing 16 officers helped cover up the killing of Laquan McDonald. This comes from Splinter News. Terrible, terrible situation. I want to read to you a little bit about this. The city of Chicago released a watchdog report showing an alleged cover-up following the 2014 police killing of black teenager Laquan McDonald. At least 16 officers were involved in numerous violations to obscure the facts around the Jason Van Dyke shooting of McDonald, who was 17. According to the documents, Van Dyke, that's the officer who actually pulled the trigger on McDonald, continuing to shoot him. If anyone has seen the video, he's continuing to shoot McDonald while he's on the ground. Van Dyke gave false statements to exaggerate the danger McDonald posed. Mayor Lori Lightfoot, now this is a new mayor. If you all have been following any of this case, the mayor before was Rahm Emanuel. Yes, the Obama's boy, Rahm Emanuel. And he refused to release the video for over a year. And it took a judge to order that the video that we all saw that became viral, it took a judge to mandate that that video be released. And that's why it became viral. And that's why we know so much more about this case. And that's why the community and so many other people have been in an uproar about this situation, because the mayor of the city was helping to, in a sense, cover up or at least not let the story get out. Chicago elected a new mayor, and this new mayor is geared towards more transparency. So just as a side note, this is why it's important for you all to get out there and vote. If you don't like the way that your city, towns and councils and police departments and water departments and finances and whatever it is and school departments, and you don't like the way that things are being run, get out and vote, and vote these people out of office. This is the case now. So here we see in Chicago where mayor was doing one thing, and here we see where this other mayor is completely doing something else and geared towards transparency. Mayor Lori Lightfoot said, "Our residents have a right to understand the decisions being made by their government. The release of these documents today represent the first of many steps we are taking to ensure our city operates with nothing short of the highest levels of transparency." The investigation, right? This is the investigation into the shooting. The objective evidence presented in the video cannot be squared with Van Dyke's claim that McDonald was attacking Van Dyke with a knife and attempted to kill him. In addition, Van Dyke made multiple material omissions. In particular, Van Dyke failed to state that McDonald was walking away from him prior to the shooting. The report also found that former Sergeant Stephen Franco reviewed and approved Van Dyke's false statements, serving to establish the false narrative that McDonald initiated an attack on Van Dyke. So that's in the Splinter News. They also have a link to the actual investigation. More damaging information, which continues to hurt the reputation of police departments and police officers all over. Not only did the officer engage in this, but 16 others, including a supervisor, probably other supervisors who are approving these types of things. To any officers out there who may be listening, listen, you gotta do the right thing. You cannot approve reports that you know to be false. You gotta be reviewing body cam footage. You gotta be reviewing cell phone footage, review whatever you can, and make sure that your officers and what they're saying is up to snuff, is up to par, and is the truth. Because once you're exposed, Now your name is out there and it's going to be trash and it's going to be all over the newspapers. The state of Oklahoma is becoming another state, the 16th state, to allow for constitutional carry of firearms. So if you are over the age of 21 or if you're 18 and in the military, you no longer need a permit to carry in the state of Oklahoma. How do I feel about this? Now, I really don't care about whether people want to carry guns or not. Here's the law enforcement aspect of it. What this means is that now police officers have a continued heightened awareness. If you're living in Oklahoma or any other 15 states, right, there's 16 states total that allow this type of constitutional type of carry. Let me just get back to this constitutional type of carry. What does that mean? In many states, you need to go get a permit to carry, which I don't agree with. I don't agree that, here's where I do agree with what they're doing. I don't agree that if the Constitution says you have the right to bear arms, now we can have an argument as to whether that means that or not. I don't fully agree. According to a book called Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, this was written by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. According to her book, and I find it very convincing, that the real purpose behind the Second Amendment was that white males were to control the native population of this land as well as control runaway slaves and or black people post the emancipation. I don't want to go down that path again. So I did an episode about that. Check that out and or check out Ms. Dunbar Ortiz's book. Very enlightening. Let's just say that the Second Amendment people out there, those who are adhered to it, really believe that they have a Second Amendment right to bear arms. Fine. Okay, so if you go off of that premise, that then everyone, every adult male who's not been, in my opinion, convicted of crimes, felonies, subject to protective orders and or been in a mental institution should have the right to bear arms. So this aspect and this revenue behind permits, people needing to acquire permits in order to carry weapons, I think that that is a false notion. I think that that is wrong. So if people have the right to bear arms constitutionally, then you ought to just be able to bear arms. If it's a right to bear arms, once again, it's a right. Contrast that with the privilege, right? You have the privilege to drive. Your driving privileges can be revoked. This is the problem that I have. I agree with constitutional carry as a philosophy, and I think that all states really ought to be constitutional carry type of states. The negative aspects of this is, once again, is the from a law enforcement aspect, is that now law enforcement officers have continued to have in the back of their minds that every single person who's over the age of 18 may be armed and may be a potential threat to my safety. And this continues to stoke this fire of unjustified shootings, particularly of black men, but just unjustified shootings. You feel that you have to control people. It hypes up aggression and assertiveness and all this type of things. So we have this super armed society. We have police officers out there who have to interact and arrest and detain and talk to and interact with these members of society. The officers don't know if the public is armed. These people of the public are armed. So therefore, their assertiveness, their aggressiveness, their heightened sense of awareness, their spider senses are all through the roof all the time. So I don't think that this is particularly a good mix. That's my feeling about it. As far as the law enforcement aspect, I don't think that it's good that officers enter into these situations where they think that people are always going to be armed, because they are armed, essentially, particularly in, you know, states like Oklahoma and Texas and whatever. However, contrast that with the Second Amendment people, and I don't think that these permits and all this kind of stuff are really necessary. And the history of the permits really goes back to black people, right? It was first black people who had to get special permits. Of course, they were often denied, but you had to get special permits. Well, white people did not need to get special permits. And then you go back to the history of the Italians and other white ethnic groups, minority groups that were coming over here. They had to get permits in order to carry. So white males who were, if you want, for lack of a better term, native born to the United States, did not have to get permits. Black people had to get permits and or were outrightly denied. Ethnic minority groups like the Italians who came over here were denied the right to bear arms unless they got permits. So this is the history of the permits, really. And so therefore, everyone had to get permits, right? How can you isolate certain groups of people? But this is what was done. So that's the history of it, just in a nutshell. So I want to finish off this episode with something a little bit different. Now, I talked a lot about law enforcement in what they can do and what we should do and everything like that. But I want to finish off this episode with something a little bit different. I want to talk about the community aspect of this. Now, what does it take to build great, big, strong communities? How do we build these strong communities that we need? Well, we need fathers in a home. We need mothers in a home. We need cohesive families and all that kind of stuff. Yes, we get that. But what do those products bring? Well, good, strong families oftentimes have gone to church. And church in Black communities has been a staple where we have birthed the civil rights movement, where it has been a shelter and a safe place when the world was beating us down and lynching us and performing all these inhumane terroristic acts towards us. The church was a safe place that we would run to and go to in order to get that solace and safety, peace of mind, and even deal with a lot of our psychology. But out of the church was born the music that we enjoy as for today, and a lot of the different preaching styles and everything like that, which has been kind of synonymous with Black culture. So on one side of it, we have the need for strong families, which produce strong churches. On the other side, we have a business aspect. And I want to bring this nexus home as far as the business aspect of it. Black people have not been good traditionally at business. Now, we have been locked out of businesses. Yes, we have been refused to get the loans in order to get the capital, in order to get the businesses up and going and to become sustainable. And so this is extremely, extremely important. I want to talk about this nexus. What's happened in the church world? Now, I don't follow too much church world gossip, but I did come across a couple of these stories, and I really want you all to bear with me just for a moment here. There's two networks, religious networks. One hails itself as being geared towards more of the Black gospel type of entertainment, type of church world, where Black Christians would tune into in order to get their daily fix of the word or encouragement, yada, yada, yada. And I'm not going to turn this into a religious podcast. Anyone who knows me personally knows that I was one time very religious. I am no longer anymore, but that's a story for another time. But I think that this story is very important. So the Word Network is owned by a man named Kevin Adell. Hear exactly what I'm saying. Kevin Adell owns this particular network, and he gears himself towards more of the African-American experience. He had an argument and disagreement with one of the presenters or the TV hosts or presenters on the show, right? The different networks have these different shows. One of them, I believe his name is Bishop George Bloomer. Now, I'm not exactly sure as to who these people are and whatever, but Bishop George Bloomer was a commentator, presenter. He had a show on the Word Network. They had some type of falling out, Kevin Adell and Bishop Bloomer. During the fallout from this particular type of incident, there was a situation in which Kevin Adell were sending text messages to the bishop. The text messages, there was a picture, and behind him were now, in the picture, Kevin Adell is wearing a white coat. He's got his arms crossed and he's got a hat on. Now, this is a meme. Someone obviously photoshopped all this type of stuff. And so behind Kevin Adell is about four preachers, all kind of smiling. And of course, the four preachers are Black men. Behind them, behind everyone in this picture, is a limousine. So the implication is that Kevin Adell is the pimp, and the four preachers behind him are the prostitutes or the hoes, right? So in essence, Kevin Adell is saying that he did not put together this meme. He was just showing the information that was out there. And this is all through via text message. And when Mr. Bloomer tells me, I don't like this image, don't send it, it's racist, Kevin Adell just continues LOLing, laughing out louding, saying it's funny and all this kind of stuff. Here's where I want to focus on. It's important for Black people to own their own businesses. It's important for anyone to own businesses within their communities, right? The problems in white rural towns is that the shop owners, the small business owners out there, have been bought out by the Amazons and were bought out by the Walmarts. So this is not just a problem that's going on in the inner city where people are coming into the inner city, urban areas, taking over Black business community. This is also happening in white rural towns as well. It's important for you to own your own stuff. And you have to be gathered around and guarded around your own stuff. And you have to be protective of your own stuff. So this is the problem that I want to bring attention to. Own your own stuff. That's why I'm trying to do this business. That's why I'm trying to do my own podcast. That's why I'm trying to open up my own business. I understand this principle that it's important for you to own your own thing. Black people in the Black church, and here's my criticism of the Black church again, is that Black people have allowed other people, we have pimped out, yes, I'm saying it, pimped out and prostituted our own gifts and refuse to become those entrepreneurs and business owners and read over contracts. And so therefore we get this type of situation where these bishops and all these elders and all these church leaders have the talent and the abilities and the mindset to open up and operate their own churches. So why is it that you don't think that you can operate your own network? Why is it that this black organization, that this word network, which is geared towards African-American, is not owned and operated by black persons? Open up your own stuff. Own your own stuff. Own your own stuff. When we own our own stuff, we are able to employ people. We get more people out of poverty. We're able to make sure that we're not begging and crying for a seat at someone else's table, begging and crying for someone else to open up the door for us. That is why what I'm saying is so important. So from strong families to strong churches to strong businesses, let's become more business minded in owning and operating our own stuff. Whatever community you're in, I'm talking to the white person in rural Nebraska. Don't sell out. The white farm owners, don't sell out. We have to break the power of these big type of corporations who are coming in being leeches and bloodsuckers and pulling the wealth and the talent out of our communities. Stop letting people come into your community and take it over. Stop letting whatever community you're in, own your own stuff in your own community. And on the same vein and on the same note, let me also speak to another situation. Kirk Franklin. Now, Kirk Franklin, for anyone who does not know, is another gospel music artist. So the gospel music also has its own version of the Grammys and celebrations and things like that. I'm not too familiar with it. I was never really into music myself. But there's this one thing called the Dove Awards. Now, the Dove, like the bird, the Dove. The Dove Awards are geared towards any particular music artist who presents Christian type of music, right? So it could be gospel, it could be country music, or whatever. They give out the Dove Awards, and Kirk Franklin wins in 2016, and he recently won in 2019. 2016, in his acceptance speech, he gives a recognition to the deaths of Philando Castile, Walter Scott, and just mentions other unarmed killings by the police. TBN, Trinity Broadcasting Network, which hosted or put on or maybe even sponsors, I don't know, the Dove Awards, edited out his speech because it was recorded, where it's not live. So when you watch it on TV, you would never have known that it was done. Kirk Franklin, fast forward. Now, he said he spoke to TBN and they promised not to do this again. They apologized and they promised not to do this again. Fast forward to 2019, he wins for whatever his category again is with the Dove Awards. Same network, Trinity Broadcasting Network, TBN, Christian Network, cuts out some of his speech. This part of the speech is when Kirk Franklin gives his acceptance speech for winning the award. He mentions the death of Tatiana Jefferson and the injustices surrounding that and saying we need some type of police reform, essentially. Again, TBN cuts out that particular part of his speech. He is, at this point in time, he is livid. He's had enough. Again, I'm saying to Kirk Franklin, I'm saying to all the preachers and pastors and to everyone out there listening, you got to own your own stuff. When you put yourself in someone else's platform, put yourself in someone else's mercy, this is what they can do and will do to you. We have let our talents, our singing, our music, and all of our abilities be used by other people. They have profited from it. And then when we speak out about the injustice about this, when we speak out or when we bend the knee during a national anthem, this is what happens. We have to stop letting other people control us and control our narrative. To those who are listening who may be of the other persuasion, you have to ask yourself, why are they bending their knee? Why are they protesting and saying these things during these award ceremonies? They're trying to get this attention out. I'm not asking you to agree with it, but I am asking you to understand it and understand and try to look at it from other people's point of view, that maybe there is something going on and maybe we should address it. So I just want to end with that. The most important thing that I want to say is that you have to own your own stuff. Now, I want to finish off this podcast, and I want you all to listen to Kirk Franklin's speech. He gave a very good and impassioned speech. And followed by that, I'm going to end off the show with a speech that was given by Tyler Perry, who opened up his own studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Tyler Perry is a Hollywood producer, studio producer, show producer, movie maker. And instead of trying to always coddle up to other people and be at their teat, if you will, he said, you know what, I'm going to build my own stuff. He started off by writing plays. From plays, he was able to get enough capital to start making his own movies. And from making his own movies, he now bought his own movie studio. Whether you like his shows, whether you like his movies or not, is irrelevant. The point is that he understands the purpose and the point of business ownership. And that is the point that I want everyone to understand. Business ownership, from churches, from strong families, to strong communities, to strong churches, to strong business opportunities and ownership. I want to end off with those speeches. So take a listen to these speeches. I think they're very powerful, and I think we can all learn something. So that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Until next time, I hope you guys enjoyed the episode. I hope you guys learned something. Please hit me back. Please write me back. If there's any show ideas you want to hear about, if there's something that comes up in the month of November that you want me to do a monthly recap on, I do plan to do a couple of shows about the movies that are coming out. So stay tuned for those. Got a lot of great episodes. If there's someone that you want me to interview, please make sure that you hit me up. CPTLHunter@gmail.com. CPTLHunter@gmail.com. I'm changing the email. It's Captain L Hunter, CPTLHunter@gmail.com. You can support the show through Venmo, Cash App, PayPal. That's all of those are CPTL Hunter. Please support the show. Once again, it's important for us to have this medium out there for everyone to get this information. Follow me on Twitter, CPTL Hunter. Follow me on Instagram, CPTL Hunter. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Until next time, please take a listen to these speeches. Be inspired by them, because I was. Thank you very much. Here we go.
Today, I feel like quitting. I am heartbroken that I even have to share this with you. In 2016, I was blessed to win an award for Best Gospel Artist at the Dove Awards. Many of you may not know the Dove Awards in comparison are the Christian Grammys, like the Stella Awards or the Gospel Grammys. For so long, the terms Christian and Gospel for many are code words for white and black, which history may teach us was a setup for this unfortunate place we find ourselves in today. During that award speech, I felt the responsibility as a Christian and a man of color to address the civil unrest at that time that was plaguing our country with the killings of Philando Castile and Walter Scott, just to name a few, by white police officers. And at the same time, the horrific killings of five Dallas police officers by an African American. I called upon the audience to join me in remembering that as Christians, when we say nothing, we're saying something. After a standing ovation, we prayed and stood in unity for all the families affected by those tragedies. We all felt that moment that it was a shift in the climate of our separate worlds. Unfortunately, when that speech aired on the Christian Network TBN, that part of my speech was edited out. I made my disappointment and frustration known to the Dove Awards Committee and to the Trinity Broadcasting Network. I never heard from TBN, and the Dove Award Committee promised to rectify the mistake so that it wouldn't happen again. In 2019, history repeated itself. I was humbled to win the same award, and during my speech, I brought attention to the murder of a Tatiana Jefferson in her home by a white police officer. I asked everyone in the audience and those viewing to join me in prayer for not only Tatiana's family, including her 8-year-old nephew who witnessed the killing, but also for the family of the police officer. Last week, during the airing of the awards on the same network again, that part of my speech was edited out. So now, after a meeting with the Dove Awards Committee and representatives of TBN, I've made the decision after prayer, consultation with my team and my pastor, Dr. Tony Evans, to not attend any events affiliated with or for the Dove Awards, Gospel Music Association, or TBN until tangible plans are put in place to protect and champion diversity, especially where people of color have contributed their gifts, talents, and finances to help build the viability of these institutions. I am aware that the word boycott often has a negative connotation and finality to it, but my goal will forever be reconciliation as well as accountability. It is important for those in charge to be informed. Not only did they edit my speech, they edited the African American experience. I'm not asking those in the gospel community to follow my decision. No, this is my personal choice to take a stand and hold responsible those in positions of power to acknowledge the issues in our separate communities that have existed from colonialism to Jim Crow. To many of the issues facing us today, I pray there will be a significant change from this hurtful experience. I look with anticipation for that day of healing, and I'm committed to contributing to that process. In the end, we will not remember the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends.
Tyler, you are a brilliant visionary that embodies what the African-American dream truly is. You, sir, are an icon living. I am deeply, deeply honored to present the 2019 BET Ultimate Icon Award to my dear, dear friend, Mr. Tyler Perry.
Thank you. I want to say a special thanks to BET, my new family. I can't wait to get started over there with our new shows. Thank you so much for this. To Scott and everybody over there, thank you so much. To Viacom, Shari, who's here, Bob, everybody. Listen, from my heart, I want to say thank you. I couldn't help but think about my mother. Sit down. I couldn't help but think about my mother. I remember being a kid, about 5 years old. She would take me into the projects with her when she played cards on Friday nights with a bunch of women. Now, these women didn't have more than a 12th grade education, but they were smart black women. They were powerful black women. They had great stories to tell. And I was a five-year-old kid sitting there on the floor playing with my Matchbox cars, listening to them talk about their men, their relationships, and their pains. And when one of them would get really sad, another woman would come in and make a joke, and they'd all start laughing. I didn't know I was in a master class for my life. I would get home, and my father would be beating my mother and doing all kinds of things and saying all kinds of stuff to her, and he would leave the room, and I'd walk in, and I'd imitate one of those women, and she would start laughing. There was a power in that that I didn't really get until I got older. I remember being about 11, 12 years old on my way to my new school, and I got to this intersection. I had to walk past pimps, prostitutes, walk through a graveyard, get to this intersection, six-lane intersection, and there was a man standing there saying, "Will someone help me cross? Will someone help me cross?" And there were all of these people that kept passing by him. I said, "I'll help you cross." So he told me he was going to my school and he was going to sell candy there. That's how he made his living. So I helped him cross the street to get there. We became good friends. His name was Mr. Butler. That moment reminded me of my mother, bringing her out of pain into laughter to help her cross. My first 10 movies were all about her subconsciously, wanting her to know that she was worthy, wanting black women to know you're worthy, you're special, you're powerful, you're amazing. All of that was about helping across. When I started hiring people like Taraji and Viola Davis and Idris Elba, they couldn't get jobs in this town, but God blessed me to be in a position to be able to hire them. I was trying to help somebody cross. When I built my studio, I built it in a neighborhood that is one of the poorest black neighborhoods in Atlanta so that young black kids can see that a black man did that and they can do it too. I was trying to help somebody cross. The studio was once a Confederate Army base, and I want you to hear this, which meant that there was Confederate soldiers on that base plotting and planning on how to keep 3.9 million Negroes enslaved. Now that land is owned by one Negro. It's all about trying to help somebody cross. While everybody was fighting for a seat at the table, talking about Oscar so white, I said, y'all go ahead and do that. But while you fighting for a seat at the table, I'll be down in Atlanta building my own. Because what I know for sure is that if I could just build this table, God would prepare it for me in the presence of my enemies. Rather than being an icon, I want to be an inspiration. So thank you, BET, my new family. Thank you, everybody. I want you to hear this. Every dreamer in this room, there are people whose lives are tied into your dream. Own your stuff. Own your business. Own your way. God bless you. Thank you, BET. Thank you, Scott. I love you guys. Thank you.